Yes, there is a new spirit in America.
What's wrong?
The spirit of a free people, united again in a common cause to stamp tyranny from the earth.
What's wrong?
Our very shores have been attacked.
What is what wrong?
Your whole country is mobilizing for total war. Your country needs you. Are you a patriotic American?
Yes, sir.
Eager to do your part?
Yes, sir.
Then there's something important you can do.
I'll do it.
You won't get a medal for doing it.
Oh, that's all right.
It may mean a sacrifice on your part.
I'll do it anyway.
But it will be a vital help to your country
I'll
in this hour of need. Shall I tell you what it is?
Yes. What is it? Tell me.
Shall I?
Tell me what it is.
Now, here's the thing that needs to be stressed, and this is what people often miss, and you and I have talked about this. The progressives, New Deal liberals, and socialists are truly interested in, and have been interested in, people internalizing the control. They were not interested in external control. They weren't interested in forcing people to be controlled. They were interested in people, here it is, controlling themselves.
Yes.
Now, they understood, as we mentioned before, that often people would not internalize that control. And unfortunately for those people, they had to be forced through compulsory schooling to do that, right? And if that didn't work, if the compulsory schooling didn't work, then unfortunately we had to have prisons for those people.
Right.
But that's not what they wanted. They didn't want the prisons. They wanted people to do this stuff on their own voluntarily. So that's really what, it's a revolution for self-control.
Right.
It's to convince people that the best way to live, the only proper way to live, is for the community.
Okay, so even this strain of thought in America had antecedents in Central Europe. This is
sure.
Kant. This is to a certain degree Hegel. And what a coincidence. Could it have been maybe the Prussian schools as a conduit that started to move some of those ideas into American thought?
I think someone needs to write a book pulling all these pieces together, telling the story of American and German transnational collaboration intellectually from the mid-19th century through the New Deal.
Mm-hmm.
That will fuck everybody up when they see that.
Your income tax. Yes, and it's your privilege. Not just your duty, but your privilege to help your government by paying your tax and paying it promptly.
Oh, what's the big hurry?
What's the big hurry? Your country is at war. Your country needs taxes for guns.
Schooling, progressivism, the New Deal, social welfare state, corporatism, that was this gigantic German-American concept. In Germany, we know it resulted in.
Yeah.
But we haven't made the connections very well to what it resulted in the United States, which was the New Deal, which everyone, of course, thinks is, well, not everyone, but everyone on the left thinks was this wonderful thing. Well, actually, it was the moment of the most intense regimentation of American people in our history. And we celebrate that. We celebrate the regimentation of people. That's what the New Deal was for.
Yeah. You know who's a big fan? Goebbels.
It wasn't just Goebbels. Hitler himself, Mussolini, and the Italian fascists loved the New Deal. And it was reciprocated. New Dealers, Rexford Tugwell, Hugh Johnson, Francis Perkins, fucking read Mussolini's and Nazi propaganda and said it publicly.
Yeah.
So did most of the progressives in the 20s and 30s. They loved Italian fascism. Charles Beard, the most important progressive historian, Columbia guy. Loved Mussolini, wrote about it publicly in the New Republic. It's online, you can read it. People, when I say this to people, they're like, oh, come on, not really. Sure.
Right.
Like, do you think I made this up? So it's a giant German-American project. There it became known as fascism. Here it became known as progressivism. Sorry, it's true. Now, are they identical? No, of course not. The Nazis tacked onto that project genocidal anti-Semitism, and other things. It's not an original part of this project. That was added on later. The Italians weren't interested in that. They were interested in what we've been talking about, this total discipline, this regimentation of the people, and their complete sacrifice for the nation state. That's what we're talking about. Killing Jews was an add-on by the Nazis. The Italian fascists and the American progressives were on the same page on the general concept here.
Leonard Peikoff wrote a book in the 80s, called Ominous Parallels. And people have pointed out to me some of the book's flaws, but the only reason I'm mentioning it here is that he opens it with this beautiful quote that would bring tears to an American progressive's eyes in the 21st century. It's the nobility of sacrifice for the greater good. It's Hitler describing the moral philosophy of Nazism. You know, but people, where would they have ever learned any of this stuff, Thaddeus?
No. Nazism was entirely about Auschwitz. That's all they think. That's all it was. It was just marching Jews into a death camp and killing them.
Yeah.
No, idiots. No, it was an entire political regime with an economy, a political economy, a philosophy, a cosmology. And guess what? That stuff looked an awful lot like Franklin Roosevelt.
Taxes to keep them fighting. Taxes to keep them rolling. Taxes to keep them coming. Taxes to beat to earth the evil destroyer of freedom and peace. This is our fight. The fight for freedom. Freedom of speech. Of worship. Freedom from want and fear. Taxes will keep democracy on the march.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is July 9th. What you just heard was the audio to a video that I made from the audio of my first discussion with Thaddeus Russell, the first installment in a Renegade History course called Why Thaddeus Russell Got Fired from Teaching American History. When the video was complete, I sent it to him before I released it, and he asked me not to release it. He said that it was missing the content of the argument. In other words, it was just a video of conclusions. And considering that it was very incendiary and it had his name on it and he's a public figure, I agreed with him. And I certainly understood why he would not want it released to the public on YouTube. So in the next two shows in this series, which will both come over the course of the next month, we're going to be covering Chapter 11 in A Renegade History of the United States called Behold a Dictator, Fascism, and the New Deal. And I'm hoping, and what will probably turn out to be 2+ hours, we can fill in the contents of that argument. As many of you know, we did a similar series a couple years ago called The American Way. And I'm actually going to wind up using some clips of that at the end of the show today. I'll explain that in a minute. Well, I guess I can explain it now. You'll find that Thad has some new ways. I'm not saying he's trying. He's not trying to upset you. But he will say some new things today that will upset many of you, really about where he's coming from philosophically. I've heard Thad describe himself as a postmodernist, and I know that's a bit of a nebulous term, but he says what's most important to him about postmodernism is the idea of relativism, that there is no objective truth. Uh-oh, right? Now, this was supposed to be a show about fascism and the New Deal. So I had to make a choice when we were recording it. Do I let this philosophical debate that honestly I was not entirely prepared for because I'm not very well versed in postmodernism, should I have let that debate derail the whole show? Because it certainly could have. We talk about it a little. Antigone Darling of Sex, Lies, and Anarchy is also in the studio with me. And she identifies as a consequentialist. So we will talk about that a little bit, but I know that's frustrating. Right? Because people would want me to go in that and say, oh, there's no truth. Is that true? And talk about objectivism. And I just decided it was unwise at that time, considering what I wanted to get out of the discussion. We only have so much access to Thaddeus Russell that I would, as I have many times in the past, just move on. And I know that's super frustrating for some people, but I'm really, really excited that it generates so much great discussion in our group on Facebook, the School Sucks Project group. Get in there and, you know, start sharing your views about these shows. I was really happy to be able to sit back and watch listeners interact with each other, argue with each other. And I'm going to try to see if Thad has any interest in getting in there. He might be able to do a little Q&A with some of you before we can do another quote-unquote call-in show. So there's an addendum at the end of the show today. One is a clip of me from the second installment of our American Way series called Pyromania, where I'm talking about maybe the origins of some of this relativism, which for me is German idealism, ironically, right? Because look what we're in the middle of topically in this show. And I do that through the lens of objectivism. But I've also included a clip of Thad being interviewed by Kyle Platt from Liberty.me explaining this postmodernist idea, what it means to him. And the whole video, if you want to find it on YouTube, is called Postmodernism for Libertarians. This is a two-parter. The goal was to draw some new parallels between the United States around the time of the New Deal and what was going on at the same time in Germany. I hope you enjoy this show. I look forward to your feedback. And more stuff is coming soon. Thanks for listening, everybody. Here we go.
It is absurd to claim, as a few have done, that the New Deal, the basis of what we now know as liberalism, was identical to either German Nazism or Italian Fascism. But it is equally absurd to ignore, as all our textbooks do, the fact that the New Deal and European Fascism grew from the same ideological roots, produced strikingly similar policies, and fostered national cultures that, if not identical, bore the resemblance of siblings. Though we think of Hitler's and Mussolini's regimes as pathological, even psychotic, and entirely alien to our political tradition, in fact, they were organically connected to the most influential American political movement of the 20th century. When the New Deal was created, few of its supporters in the United States were as effusive in their praise as were German and Italian fascists. In 1933, just 4 months after Roosevelt had taken office, the newly elected Hitler praised Mr. Roosevelt, who marches straight to his objectives over Congress, lobbies, and the bureaucracy. Hitler's compliments were not merely attempts to curry favor with the leader of the world's most powerful nation. Nazis continued to honor the New Deal as a project akin to their own. In January 1934, the Nazi Party's newspaper, the Volksische Beobachter, applauded Roosevelt's dictatorial measures. We too, as German National Socialists, are looking toward America. Roosevelt is carrying out experiments, and they are bold. We too fear only the possibility that they might fail. Many of the most favorable reviews of Roosevelt's books, Looking Forward, 1933, and On Our Way, 1934, were written by German critics who saw the New Deal and National Socialism as parallel enterprises. In 1934, a biography by the German author Helmut Magers, Roosevelt, a revolutionary with common sense, lauded the New Deal as an authoritarian revolution with surprising similarities to the Nazi seizure of power. Through the first 2 years of the Roosevelt presidency, the Volksische Beobachter continued to find many similarities between Hitler and the absolute lord and master of the United States. If not always in the same words, the Nazi newspaper wrote, Roosevelt, too, demands that collective good be put before individual self-interest. Many passages in his book, Looking Forward, could have been written by a National Socialist. In any case, one can presume that he feels considerable affinity with the National Socialist Party. Roosevelt put forward the fictional appearance of democracy, but in the United States, the development toward an authoritarian state is underway. The newspaper praised Roosevelt's adoption of National Socialist strains of thought in his economic and social policies. Hitler himself saw a kindred soul in the American president. he told the U.S. ambassador to Germany, William Dawn, that he was in accord with the president in the view that the virtue of duty, readiness for sacrifice, and discipline should dominate the entire people. These moral demands which the president places before every individual citizen of the United States are also the quintessence of the German state philosophy, which finds its expression in the slogan, "The public weal transcends the interest of the individual."
Thad, thanks for joining us again.
Thank you.
My pleasure. And joining us tonight, I'm very excited to have Antigone Darling here from Sex, Lies, and Anarchy podcast.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
My pleasure. And you were the one who introduced pretty much all of us to the work of Thaddeus Russell. And then
was that my fault? Damn. Okay.
It was. It's causing quite a bit of trouble around here. Right. And on today's show, we're going to be discussing a chapter in A Renegade History of the United States called Behold a Dictator, which is about Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal. And I thought we would open today with a quote. This is Thaddeus Russell from School Sucks Podcast, episode 261. "I think someone needs to write a book pulling all of these pieces together and telling the story of American and German transnational collaboration intellectually from the mid-19th century through the New Deal. That will fuck everybody up when they see that." Unquote. So we're gonna start there. And this is a theme that I've been exploring on the show for a while. I did a 5-hour series trying to walk the German state through the time of Kant and Fichte all the way to the end of the Second World War, looking at economics, philosophy, politics, and then trying to draw parallels to the modern United States. Now, I've come at this whole thing through the lens of objectivism. That's where I came from. And
again, I know as much about I know less about objectivism than I do about Stefan Molyneux. But from what I've seen and heard, I don't think I like it.
All right. And
you wouldn't.
And how do you feel about it, Antigone?
I think though there might be some valuable concepts in it, the language is a huge turnoff to anyone that has had a human experience in their lives.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, experience. Well, that narrows it down. First of all, I don't believe in objectivity, right? So that's a problem.
Yeah, there you go.
That's what I wanted to talk about. And just so we know the angles that we're coming at this from, you consider yourself a postmodernist, which I know very little about, and probably a lot of my audience doesn't know that much about it either. So can you just tell us what that is?
Well, it means, you know, different things for different people. It's a very loose term. I mean, for me, the piece of what's called postmodernism that I'm really wedded to and that's really important for me is essentially relativism, a rejection of truth claims across the board. You know, so I am a radical relativist. Like, I don't believe there's any truth anywhere, capital T. I mean,
this might be about to get messy then. This will be an interesting discussion. And I don't mean messy in a bad way. I mean messy in an interesting way.
So this is a difference. So one difference I have among many with a lot of libertarians, not all, but, you know, a lot of them, because they're very into science, you know, and sort of objective facts and, you know, scientific method. And in that way, they should know, guess who they resemble very closely? The early progressives, who we will be talking about now. Because that's exactly what the progressives did. In fact, they said one of their major projects was that, you know, now is the time, they said, to apply scientific principles to social problems.
What did you want to say, Antigone?
What I consider myself these days is a consequentialist. I don't want to hear about why your philosophy would be better for my life. I want to see what the logical conclusions are to all of these ideas. So if it benefits me, I'm for it. If it does not benefit me, I'm against it. I'm a consequentialist. And that's what I'm hearing you say as a radical relativist.
Yeah. So that's what you're saying is often also called perspectivism, which means that only one's particular perspective matters or is what determines anything that could be called truth. So basically you sound self-interested to me, which is awesome. That's what I'm about. Yeah, that's exactly right. That's where I am. So in other words, you can say that it's a truth for yourself, but you're just not making any truth claims for anyone else.
Absolutely
right?
Not.
Yeah, that's it. So, I mean, I think I'd like this was like the major theme when I was in New Hampshire in my talk. I would like to get everyone, this is left, right, center, everybody, away from speaking on behalf of others, right? And for fuck's sake, this is Hayek, his knowledge problem, right? I mean, this is, I'm actually agreeing with him. That's his critique of economics, is that we cannot ever know enough or anything really about most of the world's population. Therefore, we shouldn't be making decisions about how they organize their lives via economics, right?
Right. So, yeah. Explaining the problem of socialism.
Hayek is, I mean, as far as I can tell, he's down with me on that. So I don't quite understand why libertarians love this science shit.
Can you flesh that out a little bit better? I'm not sure what you mean. What science shit do libertarians love? What are your observations?
I mean, it seems sort of cultural. It's like, you know, they're very, it's sort of, I mean, that there are certain facts in the world, you know, that are incontrovertible. I don't believe that.
That are axiomatic.
They are eternal. Right?
Well, I think you discussed it in, actually, I just saw the little excerpt you did on YouTube. I'll be happy when. It was like from Nathaniel Brandon. That there's a certain prescription. There's like, okay, this is what you do. You get a college education. You get married. You have some kids that you can barely, you know, stand. You send them to college, whatever. And this is what you do to be happy. Mm-hmm. And then you retire. And that's when you're supposed to be happy because you've put in your time. You've done all this stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and then when that doesn't work out, people are like, what? I did everything I was supposed to do. I did all the, what I'm hearing Thad say is the science, like, you know, college education plus marriage and babies plus blah, blah, blah equals happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Those are all needs that we have. And I think there's only one need that we all have, and that's to stay alive.
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, that's like one of a jillion truth claims that have been made, right? That have
not everyone wants to stay alive. Can't even say that. Not everyone wants to stay alive. I think most people would agree.
Yeah. I was talking about, you know, being in a family and all that. I mean, so, you know, men, it is objectively, scientifically, biologically true, must have sex with women. If they don't, they're unnatural, right? I mean, we can go on and on. I mean, women, it's, you know, are objectively suited to being mothers. I mean, that's had profound effect on people's lives for a long, long time, right?
Unwanted children.
Goes on and on. So, I think if you're interested in human freedom, you need to get out of the business of making any truth claims for other people.
Okay, but there's dangers that go the other way, too. And, you know, the hypothesis that I put forward on the show was that we looked at two areas that in the 20th century, things got pretty messy there, Central and Eastern Europe, right? And these are places that, especially in Central Europe, especially in what was Prussia, they didn't seem to have the same enlightenment that occurred in Western Europe. And it seemed like the people living there were much more primed for fascism and communism. So, you know, we're talking about what became Nazi Germany and what became the Soviet Union. They were mystics. And they had inherited this this philosophy that followed the Holy Roman Empire nicely, and that was Immanuel Kant, and this idea that you really can't know anything. You can't trust empiricism, you can't trust reason, and that seemed to translate into trust authority.
Okay, so let's talk about fascism.
Okay.
So fascism is, you know, it's thrown around as a term all the time, and people are very unclear about it. So first of all, you have to be clear about whether you're talking about Italian fascism, German fascism, early 20th century, mid 20th century, or some other variant, right? I mean, mm-hmm. The most important ones, of course, obviously, are the Italian and the German variants, but those are very different. And so, what I do is, I'm more interested in sort of the original and what became the core principles of fascism. And the racial stuff was actually secondary until the Nazis took it over and really made racialism central to it. But if you look at the original Italian fascists in the early 20th century, and in Germany too, well, although certainly in Italy, though, I mean, the racialism stuff was not even important to many of them. What was most important was the nation state.
Mm-hmm.
So nationalism was central for them, right? Which they did, now I will say, they did have, I guess you could call, a mystical idea or conception of the nation state, and that they believed it was rooted in this particular place, in the soil, particular people that were attached to it. Of course, you know, having nothing to do with scientific method whatsoever. So there is that. But besides all that, if you look at the way that fascist regimes actually organized themselves and the societies that they held sovereignty over for a time, you could argue, and many have argued, fact, that it was the culmination of Enlightenment thinking, that it was hyper-rational, If what is the military, right? It is the ultimate application of Enlightenment principles to human activity. It is the total rationalization of human beings, human bodies.
How is the military the height of Enlightenment thinking, unless I misheard you?
It's making people into numbers, into machines, into objects, into perfectly functioning machines, right? That's what you become as a soldier. It's a deliberate attempt. I mean, and they say this, it's a deliberate attempt to take away your humanity, your freedom, your desires, anything that is irrational, anything that does not serve a particular, very narrow function. You become part of a machine, right? This should not be news to anyone who knows anything about the military. Right?
Sure. Do you feel, Antigone, do you feel like we're mixing terms here? Like maybe some terms are unclear that we need to clarify, like the Enlightenment? And, you know, I think a lot of people, obviously, when they think of the Enlightenment, they think of the political philosophy that they at least talked about in the United States, right? Which was more about individualism and human freedom.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, so for me, I mean, the way I think of the Enlightenment is it is replacing God as the source of knowledge with science. And I don't think any Enlightenment philosopher would have a problem with me defining it that way. I mean, that's sort of what they said, right? So, this is really what we're getting at here. That's exactly what the progressives said should be done with social problems, applies the scientific method to them.
And who funds this science? The state.
Yeah. So, right. And so the state also is everybody, every historian I know of basically sees the modern nation state as also the culmination of Enlightenment thought. Right. So instead of popes and, you know, divine right monarchs running the show, we have educated, enlightened citizens who use their rational minds to make big political decisions. Right. So that's a very Enlightenment thing. Again, libertarians need to get out of the Enlightenment business, man. It's no good. it's the philosophical source of everything they hate. I don't quite understand why it's even an issue.
Yeah, like I call statism just like it's modern religion. And there's so many like atheists who will know that, you know, that's all bullshit. Some bearded guy in the sky. That's bullshit. But Obama should be taken seriously for whatever reason. Or like if they can prove something using the Constitution, then it's valid. And that's, you know, it's not valid to say that, oh, in the Bible, there's a virgin birth and hence virgin births exist. That's not.
And they didn't have their moment either. Like, you know, there hasn't been the, okay, we can see all the way back through a telescope to the Big Bang and there is no God. That moment hasn't come, but their ideas seem to fail miserably all through the 20th century. So in a way, it's almost more of a religion, mm-hmm. I think. Like, maybe there's some people who can still be holding out some hope or some faith in a religious sense, but I think that this has empirically failed, you know, the progressive idea.
No, but it has I hate it as much as you do, but it has a rational basis though, unlike religion. So there's an idea. So here's the thing. You identify a particular social problem, whatever it is, poverty.
Okay.
Then you apply scientific method to it. And they're actually correct, right? You can actually solve poverty through statist means. I mean, mm-hmm. it's been done. Well, guess who did it, by the way? The Germans in the 1930s. Okay, that they did accomplish that. Mm-hmm. Now, we can talk about, and we will talk about, all of the other consequences of that program, but they, in fact, basically, there almost basically was no unemployment and poverty in Germany in the 1930s.
Right.
So they can do it. And how did they do that? They didn't go run around talking to shamans or, you know, appealing to superstition or rolling the dice. They sat down and they said, okay, so we have X number of people in this town who are poor, and we have Y resources over here, and we need to build a train track to take source resources from here to there and deliver. You know, it's a very rational scientific method process to do that.
Okay, but they were also like a mystic death cult, right? Like with the, what was that group, the Teutonic Knights? That they the whole Aryan Superman Atlantis looking for biblical treasures, like there was both things going on, right?
Yeah. But again, that's the Germans tacking on their weird little superstitions to a very coherent, essentially rational philosophy of fascism. So everyone needs to go back and read sort of Mussolini and the original fascists in Italy in the 1910s and 20s and 30s. And its deeper roots, which are in the Catholic Church in the 1890s, Pope Leo in the Rerum Novarum in 1892 laid out what's what we now called corporatism, called it that, right? He named it that, or the church did name it that. And that's really the basis of fascism. And everyone agrees, this is not controversial. This is not that Russell being weird. This is everyone agrees on this. And that's, that is a system in which workers and employers behave as a family, right? And the state and its citizens also behave as a family. So it's a cultural prescription, right? So he's saying what the Pope said was, employers should treat their workers like paternalistic, caring fathers, but in return, workers should treat their employers like also fathers, right? And not strike, not rebel, accept their lot in life as workers, as subordinate. And also that was true, he said, for citizens in a nation state. So there should be a kindly, beneficent father figure at the head of it, but also citizens should treat him that way. Be loyal to the nation state. So that the corporate body. So the nation state and the workplace would become a single body for the Pope. And that became the basis of fascism as a political and economic philosophy, which, as you know, became also the basis for the New Deal in the United States.
That's the organic connection that you speak of in the chapter.
If you read the Rerum Novarum, it's not, I mean, the Pope's not like talking about, he never mentions, well, he doesn't base his argument on scripture. it's written like a social scientist would write it. I mean, it's a very rational document, right? I'm not, you know, I hate every word of it, of course. It's the root of all evil in my view, but it's not like he says, well, it says in the Bible, therefore we should do this. He sort of says, well, here's the situation on the ground in Italy right now. We have tremendous class conflict, workers hate employers, they're going on strike, communists are coming in, blah, blah, blah. Right? He sort of observes it. He observes the problem, diagnoses it, and then offers a prognosis, which is actually quite effective. So quite rational, and it's quite progressive in its early, in the early definition of that.
You have anything to add, Antigone, before we move on?
Well, I was just thinking about how, like, religion was one of the big, like, first evils that really told people how they should organize themselves and what they should do. And from my understanding, people used to like live in, you know, large tribes and large communities. You have Dunbar's number, 150 people or something like that. And this nuclear family idea is quite new. And I think it also separates people, and we don't really have community like we used to. And so these religions, and in saying religions, I also include the state, broke people apart into these tiny, tiny little nuclear families, and then try to fix the problem that they created. It's like that, you know, the Harry Brown metaphor that he had, like the government breaks your legs and then gives you a wheelchair and you're supposed to, or crutches, and you're supposed to like thank them for the crutches.
They might do wheelchairs now.
Right. Obamacare.
Now, Harry Brown, that was like 15 years ago. He said that you probably have a motorized
scooter. Get one of those.
Ooh, a motorized scooter.
Yes. Yes. They created the nuclear family, which is the most difficult, onerous way to live.
Right. You have very few options without, you know, uncles and, you know, whatever other extended family members around. People will just move for their job, right? They are subservient to this job, right, to this 401k or whatever, and they just don't really have the meaningful relationships used to have.
This is awesome. This all brings a lot of stuff together for me. Because also what happens is you get shamed when you rely on the community economically or otherwise, right? You should be able to be economically self-sufficient, right? If you rely on neighbors or the broader community, forget the state, I'm talking about ordinary people, that's actually, you're seen as lesser, right? Which is a very classic bourgeois idea, which I think, again, libertarians buy into too much. So if you look at like Roderick Long's stuff on mutual aid, which is awesome, you know, and Rothbard and the rest of them, I mean, that's what they're about. They said that before the goddamn modern nation state, people relied on their communities for things like welfare and health insurance, right? And then the nation state not only crowded them out through its monopoly, but also the culture started shaming people who did that. The best American person, especially man, but now it's women too, you know, is the self-sufficient, self-regulating individual who needs no help from anyone, who has five children or two children, right? And never needs help from anyone, not just the state, but from anyone else, right? That's the best American. That's the person who's celebrated. So So that again sort of militates culturally against the old mutual aid, right? Which anarchists and libertarians champion. And I think I do too. And I like that. I don't know. It appeals to me more. And this wasn't family. This was just sort of like the neighborhood, or it was an ethnic association. I mean, it certainly beats the shit out of like social workers coming to your house and inspecting how you go shopping before they give you the check for welfare.
Have you heard of a book called I think it's called The Tragedy of American Compassion. Have you ever heard of that, Antigone?
No.
It talks about how basically the state took over and slowly drove all that stuff out. You know, starting with the New Deal, accelerating obviously in the Great Society, and you know, moving from there.
My friend David Beto, historian at University of Alabama, libertarian. He's written a history on that too in the United States. It's fantastic. He's awesome.
So we're in an interesting distance away from my outline, and I'm wondering how
that
we
happens.
Can. I'm wondering how we can. Yeah, no, it's great. I'm happy that we are. I'm wondering how we can start wandering back.
Let's just do it. Because there's some things I do want to say about this, you know, about the New Deal, right?
Just so it's super clear to everyone who's listening.
Yeah.
You talk about, at the very end of the chapter, these, you know, not being competitors, even, you know, despite what people think, because of the Second World War, but more like brothers competing for this control. So who's the parent?
Well,
they have a common parent.
Well, there was a competition to become the parent of Europe.
Right.
If you put it that way, that's not even really that controversial. I mean, I think most liberal historians would agree with me on that. I mean, that's what World War II, when you get right down to it, was and certainly became. It became, you know, that was the consequence of World War II, was that the United States essentially became the parent of Europe. I mean, hard to deny that. I mean, look who's run the place essentially since then.
Well, it was really, it seemed like at the start of the war, it was the old imperial powers saying, who does Germany think they are? Basically. And that would have been France and Britain. And there's a lot of research, and this is something we've covered on my show in the past too. British intellectuals had really infiltrated, starting around the time of World War I, and the United States government and military apparatus was very much a puppet of the falling and collapsing British Empire. Now, I still agree with everything that you're saying, but Britain just didn't have the strength anymore, especially after the First World War and after the Second World War. So it became the United States, kind of like this shell that British intellectuals and decision makers were using. So you're familiar with the Ministry of Information, these people that they sent here at the time of the First World War to get all the Wilson guys, you know, in favor of doing something like this. And that obviously continued into the Second World War. And that might not be super relevant to this conversation, but I definitely agree with what you're saying, that they were all trying to be not just the parent of Europe, but pretty much the parent of the world at that point, right?
United States.
Well, I've never really believed that Germany had those kinds of designs, nor Italy. I think that was more of a regional struggle for them.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, we totally agree. Yeah. No, the United States, it's progressive, the progressive wing of the United States political structure. Absolutely. I mean, they said it. I mean, it's not, again, not controversial. If you look at progressive thinkers from the 1890s through at least the 1960s, through the end, sort of mid-Vietnam War, they're pretty unabashed about it. And Obama's kind of revived this, by the way. Not only can we oversee the world's affairs, but we should. So the early progressives, and I mean from the 1890s to sort of 1960s, you know, based it almost in the divine, sort of this idea of American exceptionalism, right? That we are so special and so great that we owe it to the rest of the world to extend ourselves to them or make them like us, make them be like us.
Mm-hmm.
And Obama actually, he said just that about a month ago. So I have a question for you guys.
Sure.
Would you say, or do you say, that the New Deal was fascist? Like when people, if it comes up in conversation or you get into an argument with some liberal or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
New Deal comes up somehow. Do you say, or would you say, well, that was fascism?
This might not be the answer that you're looking for, but I try to never use the word fascist in arguments because I've recognized that, you know, these are hot potatoes that I have, and I want to be careful about how I throw them at people. And obviously fascism and fascist is a very incendiary word that I try not to use. So how would you define fascism?
To me, it starts with corporatism. And to
okay,
most historians of fascism, the basis of it is corporatism. So you have to understand what corporatism is.
Well, I would say that it had certainly strong fascist elements in it, considering the cartelization of industry, which I always thought, I mean, until I read what you put in the book, I always saw that as like an economic unintended consequence. And this was actually a deliberate effort to put these people together into what was it called? It had a different name in every place, right? In Italy, Germany, and the United States, these corporate cartels. So what was it called in the United States?
Well, I mean, it was operated by the National Recovery Administration. Industrial councils, I think. Yeah, they had a different name in each country and slightly different formats in each country. For instance, labor had varying degrees of power in each state. Labor had a little bit more power here, very little in Germany and very little in Italy, although it depends on how you define it. I mean, there were labor representatives in their industrial councils, but they were more, boy, it's even hard to say this, perhaps more subservient to the state there, although they were awfully subservient to the state here as well.
Yeah.
So no, the essential, and no one's ever challenged this, and I'm like, there are at least four or five historians who have said this, you know, I mean, the basic structure of the economies were quite, quite similar. And more importantly, they came from the same source, which was corporatist philosophy. So one thing you have to do understand, though, like the full-on corporatist model here was pretty short-lived. So it was with the National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933, began with that, and it was overruled by, declared unconstitutional by the Supreme Court in 1935, and it was abolished in 35. So it had a two-year run. Now that was the full-on total corporatist model that was nearly identical to the model in Germany and Italy. However, there was, of course, great deal of corporatism going on in the New Deal. The New Deal was essentially corporatist in all sorts of ways. One way that's very important, which we see echoes of now, was that all the social welfare policies were co-written by corporations. So if you look at, and you know, Rothbard was awesome on this, and he actually, it's funny, I read him in graduate school, not knowing anything about who he was. And I thought he was a new lefty because he edited this volume, this anthology of essays on the New Deal, which was all new lefties and him, New Deal and progressivism. And, but he and others in that era of the new left totally revealed the New Deal for being corporatist from the bottom up. I mean, they showed that all the major legislation of the New Deal was basically authored or co-authored by big business.
Right. Well, and that's the same thing with like health insurance companies writing Obamacare stuff, right? And I recently on Sex, Lies, and Anarchy did an episode about food stamps where I had people call in if they wanted to convince me to not get on food stamps because I am eligible. And that was hilarious. So, yeah. And no one could really convince me to not sign up for them. I ended up not signing up for them because I don't want to voluntarily give the state my information. That's why, not any kind of moralistic reason. But in reading up for that show, I think it was like Citizens Bank or something, like one of the big banks actually contracted with the state of New Hampshire to supply the little plastic cards for EBT. Like they are completely and totally for this to like help the state run the social welfare programs.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it was like a $2 million contract just from one state right there.
Yeah, Obamacare is very, very similar to a lot of the New Deal legislation. I mean, it's a little less socialized than New Deal worth, but the way it came about was almost identical. When it was going down, when it was being crafted, I was looking at it and like, oh Jesus, this is like a rerun almost entirely of the 1930s with the Roosevelt administration. You know, you have like big representatives from big pharma and the health insurance companies literally coming to the White House and literally sitting at the table and literally writing down together what the law should be. And then a few years later, it is the law. I mean, that is how Social Security was crafted. That is how aid to families with dependent children, which became the major welfare program, was crafted down the line. So here's what I say when people say, oh, you're saying that the New Deal was fascist and that's stupid, which I get all the time.
So wait, one second before you do that. Are we in agreement pretty much with my answer that, you know,
that you want to stay away from the word fascism?
I want to stay away from the word fascism, but obviously the cartelization of industry, which was intentional. Mm-hmm. Do you have any?
What did you say the term fascist is? You used a term. Oh, incendiary.
Yeah.
That's actually a problem. And one of the things I want to do is make it not incendiary. And that requires decoupling it from the common conception of it, which is Auschwitz.
Yeah.
And that's about it.
Good
and
luck.
That's about it. Right. So when people hear, you know, when 99% of the population hears fascist, they think Auschwitz and that's the end of it.
They think tiny mustache.
Yeah. It was Hitler, you know, and Jews being thrown into incinerators and that's it. It's a whole political philosophy, guys. Like, I'm not speaking to you, I'm speaking to the world.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, and it starts, and it actually had nothing to do with Jews, nothing.
Mm-hmm.
The originators of fascism as a philosophy in Italy in the early 20th century were not really concerned about Jews. They don't really make an appearance in much of their literature. Certainly weren't anywhere near as central as they were in German thinking about it. It's the making of individuals part of the body of the state. That's what it is. Corporatism. It is making you become the flesh of the state. There is, you know, they were very influenced by Christianity, right? So that idea about, you know, becoming the flesh of Jesus, it's very similar. So instead of becoming the flesh of Jesus, you become the flesh of the state. That means a total merger of your identity with the nation state. That's what fascism is. Everyone agrees on that. That's sort of at the very core of it. That's the political psychological core of it. And the economic philosophy which flows from that is corporatism. So you become devoted in your economic activity to the nation state. And that means if you're a businessman, by the way, or a worker. So if your interests as a businessman, your individual interests as a businessman or a woman, will always be secondary to the interests of the nation state. Now they didn't fully nationalize everything, but they'd always, whenever a businessman's interest conflicted with the nation state, the interest of the nation state, the businessman was punished.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's ways around saying, look out, everyone, here we go, nationalizing everything. I mean, corporations in this country today act as police, act as tax collectors, act as spies. You know, all the government has to do is ask because they want the favors returned that they see themselves getting from government.
Right. And so one of the things that people are really idiotic about on the left, and I just saw this the other day and it drove me up a wall, is that there's a very common argument, although I wouldn't quite say it's the dominant argument, but it's a very popular argument on the left, and I'm talking about among academics, which is that businesses in Germany were fully behind fascism from the get-go, that it was really in many ways a product of big business. And it's just false in the face of it, because you can look at the Nazi regime punishing all sorts of businesses for not falling in line with the national interest. Now, did some particular businesses and some particular sectors of the economy benefit from the Nazi regime? Absolutely.
Yeah.
Just like the New Deal did. But were others punished? Absolutely. Many lost out. Many were driven out. Some were shot, you know, and some had their businesses seized, their property seized. If you were in the business of producing jazz records, this is a fact. In the 1930s in Germany, there were actually many of them. Jazz was enormously popular. It was probably more popular in Germany than anywhere else in Europe in the 20s and 30s. If you were a businessman doing that, producing phonograph records of jazz recordings in the 1930s, was very popular. You lost big. Why? Because the Nazis banned jazz, right? So, I mean, to say that, and that this was big business, by the way. Deutsche Grammophon was the biggest music maker in Germany. This was a major corporation. This was not small potatoes we're talking about. And that's just one example. In other words, if your business was devoted to consumer products that were devoted to pleasure like that,
yeah,
and not into creating sort of a disciplined Volk people, right?
Yeah. Oh, sure. So basically,
we're not going to be your friends, right?
Yeah.
You may have survived it. A handful survived it, but they were not your friends.
Right.
They were the enemy. They did everything that you'd survive despite the Nazi regime. So to say that big business as a whole had reason to support the Third Reich generally is just crazy. It makes no sense. Did some support it? Absolutely. Right. Those who bought into and those whose businesses happened to coincide with the interests of the nation state, the warfare, welfare nation state. Absolutely. So if you were in the business of building sports stadiums, yeah, you benefit because they were big on that. They built a bunch of sports stadiums because they love sports, because that instilled a martial spirit in people. But if you were in the business of making booze. I think they crack down on the liquor industry as well.
Yeah.
So no, not so much.
Same idea though, but let's talk about it in the United States with the new deal. It's pretty much the same, right?
Yeah.
And we're saying before World War II, because it seems like from the get-go, Germany's war machine buildup, because of their position in Central Europe and the perception of threat that they faced, you know, before the United States did, it seems like that was a bigger part of their industrial plan. So if we just have the question about the New Deal, not during the period of World War II, but in the decade before World War II, mm-hmm. who are the winners and the losers in the United States?
Yeah, so with the NIRA, the National Industrial Recovery Act, mm-hmm. And the establishment of these industrial cartels in every major industry, not every industry, but every major industry, they suspended antitrust laws in those industries. They established, the industrial cartels were basically small groups of government officials and representatives from big businesses in those industries who together decided by fiat prices, wages, and production quotas. So it was that was cartelization of those industries, obviously. Now, guess who lost? Every business who wasn't represented.
That's what I was going to ask. Are they picking, are they, once these cartels are formed, it basically seems like the government is picking the winners and losers, right? Because they can just use the creation of this cartel to, I mean, the same thing exists today with, like we see it with IP all the time, right? You push out the little guys, so you prevent new competition. So is that how it was used?
Yeah, so the barrier to entry in those markets was insurmountable, basically. Steel and coal and mining and rubber and all the big heavy industries were pretty much locked down. There was no way to enter them during that time. And a lot of small producers, a lot of small businesses, or even actually medium-sized businesses, you know, not mom and pops at all, were forced out. Or they were forced to merge with the larger companies. So, yeah, no, I mean, this is totally non-controversial. And if anyone who knows anything about the history of the New Deal would agree with this. They say it was a good thing, though. I mean, a lot, you know, sort of the liberal historiography is that was necessary to save the economy. The Supreme Court disagreed, or the Supreme Court didn't disagree with that, but they disagreed that it was lawful. And so very funny thing happened. This Jewish kosher butcher in Brooklyn sued them because he was fined for violating one of the codes established in the poultry industry by the big businesses who were part of the cartel. And got a fine for, I don't know, not cleaning his tables properly or whatever, or overproducing or having the wrong prices or the wrong wages. I don't know what it was. And he sued and it went all the way to Supreme Court. Schechter was his name. It was a Schechter case in 1935. And the Supreme Court said, yeah, the Commerce Clause doesn't say anything about the federal government choosing winners and losers and micromanaging the economy in this way. And they threw it out. So was that fascist? Well, yeah. I mean, I don't know, you know, so is that Auschwitz? No, it's an entirely different thing than Auschwitz, but was it, you know, it was nearly identical, and I'm not the only historian to say this, it was nearly identical to the economic system that was at the core, the genesis of fascism, you know, beginning with the very first fascists, people who've called them fascists, called themselves fascists.
Okay, I have a question.
I mean, there's no getting around it. I mean, that's, you know, now, does that mean the entire thing was fascist? No, but we can talk about the other parts of the New Deal and its similarities as well.
Well, let's stick with that for a minute, unless you have anything right now. All right. So we're talking here, all these things that we just covered are done under the National Industrial Recovery Act or the National Recovery Administration, right?
Correct.
So who are the major players before, when we're talking about using the word fascism, who are the major players in those organizations or working in those initiatives? Like, who comes to mind for you?
Yeah, so Hugh Johnson ran it. At first, he was tossed out eventually, but Hugh Johnson was part of what was called the Brains Trust, the Roosevelt administration, one of his top advisors.
Yeah,
and he was head of the NRA at first. Hugh Johnson's a great character, and you know he just illustrates the argument. I mean, if you want to just go ahead and say that the New Deal is fascist, Hugh Johnson's your man because he, like many New Dealers, was a big-time explicit champion of Mussolini for many, many years before they took office. Several of the New Dealers passed around copies of Mussolini's work and were big champions of his. And I'm talking about the heads of, you know, I'm talking about cabinet level people in the Roosevelt administration, but the people who really, the brains trust who really planned out the major legislation in the New Deal were mostly big fans of fascism.
Well, he did have a military background, right? And right. What did he did selective service. That was his big initiative.
He loves, so he wrote about this. Yeah, he loved selective service, like all they all did.
Yeah.
Loved the draft. I mean, progressives as a body, with very few exceptions, not only accepted the draft, they loved it in World War I. Yeah, he had a position in the Wilson administration, part of the work or fight program, mm-hmm. which was really just, it was essentially you rounding up so-called slackers and telling them and forcing them to either be conscripted into the army or work in defense industry or go to prison. Those were your choices. But it was a nationwide dragnet. I mean, they had police. I'm just writing about this now, actually. They had police, they had the army, and they had huge vigilante groups across the country combing the nation for these slackers. Jeez. There were close to 500,000 people, heroes. These are, to me, the American heroes. I mean, there's no one more heroic. About 500,000 men who just refused to do it. And about 40% of them, and a lot of people don't know this, were in the South, in the rural South.
Yeah.
Poor, white, a lot of blacks too, white and black, but a lot of poor Southerners just were like, this is not our war. We're not interested. And they literally, they went into the bush and they didn't come out and they hid. But so the nation state organized this massive dragnet to pull them in to either the army or the defense industries or prison.
So that
was Hugh Johnson. So that was Hugh Johnson's big thing. And he loved it. He loved it. And he wrote about it. And he hated that all these guys were hanging out in pool rooms and bars instead of fighting in the war or working in a factory.
Okay, so essentially, one of the reasons why he fits into this picture so well, this larger progressive agenda picture, is his goal is essentially to militarize the whole society.
Yeah.
And to regimentation of the whole society.
Yeah, he said it. I mean, yeah, and that's Teddy Roosevelt. You know, I mean, that's the whole progressive generation, which is what I'm writing about right now. I mean, that's what they were about. And they said it, and they were straight up. The other big dude in the New Deal, in the Brains Trust, Roosevelt's Brains Trust, who was really very much like this, was Rexford Tugwell.
Yeah.
Wow, that's a name.
Yeah, he was quite an amazing guy. So he was a Columbia professor, academic, intellectual, wrote books, and was a huge admirer of fascist Italy and wrote about this very explicitly. And he wrote about not making society into a military unit, although you could certainly see that in there, but into a factory. So he wrote about, and here's the Enlightenment. Here's Enlightenment rationalism. He wrote about very explicitly making society work like a machine, which meant making each individual work like a cog in the machine, reducing each person to his or her function for social order. And Tugwell was one of the top people in the Brains Trust, along with Hugh Johnson.
Let's go a little more into Tugwell, because there's another kind of disturbing parallel here between the United States and Germany. In the book, you talk about these influences that he has, I think, when he's a student or maybe when he's at Columbia. One is an economist named Simon Patton, and the other one, I think, is a teacher he has named Scott Nearing. And right. They're kind of fantasizing about this cleansing, right? Getting a better, cleaner, more efficient, progressive society. Through the eradication of what one of them calls the vicious and inefficient, right? And as he's working his way up, really, I think in the Wilson administration, obviously he gets another opportunity with the Great Depression. Tugwell's thing is he wants to make that a reality. Like, so we're actually talking now about, and you do cover this in the chapter as well, eugenics in the United States. And not the good kind of eugenics, where it's like, hey, you two are pretty and handsome. Let's say, you know, you should fuck. The bad kind of eugenics, where you sterilize and kill people.
I've never heard of the good kind
of eugenics. It's called positive
eugenics.
Positive eugenics? You've never heard of positive eugenics? It's like getting, they did it in Nazi Germany.
I think that's what my neighbor does, like calling me Mrs. What? Anarchy and telling me to have babies.
No, but they had they had breeding programs like this in Germany.
Yeah.
Where they would say, hey, you two are blonde and you have some blue eyes.
Well, didn't they actually like lock up young girls and have the young blonde boys go visit them in order to make more blonde babies?
I think that's a possibility. They did have programs in Nazi Germany for
this. There was a movie in the United States in the 1970s or 80s when I was a kid about that, like a dystopian science fiction movie. I forget what it's called. Anyway, it was basically positive eugenics. Like the handsome, athletic people were, you know, forced to procreate. So,
yeah, it's a happy, friendly eugenics.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like dating eugenics. We could have dating eugenics websites.
It's a good name for a dating site.
Oh, dear Lord.
PositiveEugenics.com.
I think it's discovered like a new niche in the market. Many historians have written about this. I mean, it's not many, but several. That the Nazis got a lot of their ideas about eugenics from Americans. So Americans really were the pioneers in eugenics as a science. Paul Popenoe was the man, and in fact, Paul Popenoe, his laboratory, which was the national and became sort of the international research center for the eugenics movement in the early 20th century, was about 5 miles from where I'm sitting, and he had a base, or he had followers at Occidental College where I'm teaching. So progressives were really into eugenics. Current liberals who know this, they when they're forced to, they acknowledge it, but they try to just sort of brush past it quickly when they do their history of progressivism. And I actually have been thinking about this because I thought for a long time it didn't actually fit their broader philosophy, right? Because to me, they're Enlightenment people. They're rational, highly rationalistic. Is eugenics strikes me as not rational. Like, cause you need, if you're going to really create a perfectly functioning economy, you're going to need the ditch diggers. You're going to need people to do the shit work.
Well, no, but it's just one part of a larger plan though, because you, once you get people to do exactly what you said, which is the nation state becomes a part of them. How did you say that again? That merging your identity,
the body, corporatism.
Yeah,
that you are just a part of the nation state,
right.
And so in that way, if you're a ditch digger, the nation state needs these ditches.
Happy to serve.
You are so important to the nation state,
right?
In your small way.
So you get rid of all the the cripples and the genetically deficient, because you don't want to rely on them for ditch digging. You just want to get to your pure stock, you know, so there aren't a lot of variables, there aren't a lot of wild cards, everybody's in good shape, and then you have them merge their identity with the nation state, and you say, congratulations, you're the people's ditch digger.
Right. Okay, yeah, I mean, I never thought it would work, right? Eugenics, does it work? I don't know. I mean, if it works, then yeah, it's perfectly rational and in line with the Enlightenment.
It depends on who you ask, I think, too.
I mean, could it work? I don't know. Well, yeah, if you ask Charles Murray, he would say yes, probably.
Right. Well, I think the thing, too, is that as far as the rationality of it, it was like, I think for a lot of people who seem like they'd been trying to justify, we talked about this before, people who are trying to justify the existence and the expansion of their power for centuries, for millennia, religion and mysticism worked so well. When science showed up, and people were like, yeah, you might not be a god. You might not talk to God. And obviously that happened over a long time. They said, oh, no problem. Science, you know?
Yeah. I take it back. Eugenics is perfectly consistent with the Enlightenment.
Okay.
so is phrenology, you know, the measuring of skulls and stuff, which progressives were big into as well.
Horse man.
For a while. They overthrew it after. They thought through it. Only because they thought it was just bad science, not because... it was an attempt, right? Scientists aren't always right, and they will tell you that. They will be the first persons to acknowledge that they are not always right. But what they are committed to, is the use of the scientific method. to solve problems, right? So that was that's what phrenology and eugenics was an attempt to apply the scientific method to social problems. That's an Enlightenment project. They found out it just wasn't through trial and error that it wasn't good science, but the attempt was perfectly consistent with Enlightenment thinking.
Well, how is that? The scientific method is you know, using basically a test. Are you objecting to the scientific method generally in practice?
No. This is a very longer conversation, but
I think people will be mad at me if I don't ask that. Yeah,
it depends on what the question is.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what I would say. So, I mean, sure. I like to fly in the air in machines. I like to go from Los Angeles to New York in less than 100 hours, right? So it's like, I do like when they answer that particular question, yeah. How do we get this body to that place in 6 hours? You know, I say to them, please use the scientific method. You know, I like that. That serves my interest, right? But there's a bunch of other questions I don't want the scientific method applied to, right? Like, who should I have sex with? What food should I eat? What school should my son go to? Right. What topics should I teach in my classes? Right. These are all things that have been decided, by the way, through the use of the scientific method in the past. This is what progressives have done.
In all
those cases that I just named, right. They've had recommendations based on the scientific method.
But then let's make that about progressives. Let's not make that about the scientific method, because I'm pretty happy with my results using the scientific method to decide what I should eat for, like,
Oh yeah, absolutely. No. So God bless scientists, you know, I want them around. As I said, I love to be able to go to New York City in 6 hours, you know, from LA. And so they do that. But let's keep them in their place. if you look at progressives, that's really what they were about. I mean, that's what they said. They said, we need to apply scientific method to all these social problems. So the city manager model, which they instituted, and my fair hometown of Berkeley, California, I think was the first city to do it, to use it. That's what it was. These were engineers. These were people trained as engineers.
Mm-hmm.
Scientific physical engineers who were nominated by city councils. This is a progressive movement to manage these cities. So many sort of medium-sized cities, and in fact, a couple of larger ones too, were essentially run by engineers for a long time. And that, you know, is that who you want making political decisions?
No. I mean, I've railed against what I've usually called, and I think you even use the phrase in the book, and John Taylor Gatto, who we've talked about before, uses it all the time, scientific management of human beings.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, none of us are fans of it, for sure.
Gatto uses that term?
Gatto is where I learned it.
Awesome.
I mean, you could come up with it, we could come up with it on our own, I guess, but he uses it over and over and over again in his book, The Underground History of American Education.
Yeah. Yeah, and so, okay, and guess who else did that? They had some mystical ideas, especially the Germans did, but, you know, when they got down to business...
They had scientists.
When they got down to organizing their societies,
yeah,
that's what they did. They applied the scientific method to social problems, including the Jew problem. And so they did it very, very efficiently, right? They thought through that shit, and they applied logic logic to the Jewish problem, right? So they didn't kill them all until they used their labor up.
Yeah.
For instance, right? And because they understood that these were useful bodies for a time. So their fanatical, mystical hatred of Jews actually was superseded for quite a while by Enlightenment rationalism, you know? They yeah. understood that these bodies could serve the nation state, could serve a socially coherent, efficient state. So, you know, people don't understand this. Like, the final solution wasn't arrived at formally until 1942, until the United States entered the war and they knew that they were going to lose the war. They start actually, as a policy, killing Jews. And killing Jews as wholesale practice didn't happen until 6 months before that, until the summer of 1941. So the Nazis came into power in 1933. From 1933 to the summer of 1941, that's 8 years, their policy was not to exterminate the Jews. Their policy was to make life so uncomfortable for the Jews that they would voluntarily leave. People don't understand that because it wasn't socially efficient. They understood, and other reasons they just didn't do it, right? So people think of Nazis and they think, oh, well, Jews were like on the chopping block day one. No. So the anti-Semitism actually became sort of opportunistic once the United States entered the war. We got to get rid of all these people now because we're going to lose this fucking war. That's when the death chambers went into operation.
Okay. Do you know in government school textbooks what was discovered about what had been happening to Jews in 1945 is actually in the books, anachronistically used as a justification for the U.S. entering the war?
Sorry, say it again.
All right. This began, as you said, as a final solution, once the United States entered the war.
Yep.
In the public school textbooks, what began as a response to the United States entering the war is used as a justification for the United States entering the war.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, and that's been demolished. Like, no serious historian takes that seriously. Like the claim that Roosevelt was motivated to save the Jews. Like that was no one takes that seriously. And then we just recently, like in the last year, somebody discovered a whole bunch of stuff in the Roosevelt archives that he's just blatantly anti-Semitic, which was standard for his milieu. I mean, the sort of upper class Northeastern elite was, you know, famously anti-Semitic. They didn't give a shit about Jews.
Yeah, like Lincoln thought the blacks were inferior.
War to bomb the tracks.
Well, historians might know that.
What's that?
But historians might know that, but the people who have gone to public schools and private schools as well.
And college.
Think that Lincoln really loved black people and FDR really loved Jews.
Loved everybody.
And I'm not surprised to hear you say, yeah, FDR is an anti-Semite. Of course.
If you want to talk about what's in like high school textbooks, I mean, that's,
the stuff I'm trying to save people from with my show, you know, and that's those were the books that I read and locked in a closet my first year of teaching. But yeah, I mean, it's in there. It's shocking. I don't know the last time you looked at a public school history textbook that covers this period, the Great Depression and World War II. I don't know if you should do that. That might be discouraging for you. Like people who have your knowledge of history, I would stay away from that shit because it might be very frustrating.
Oh yeah. How old is Toby? 11?
He's 12. And so he just finished 7th grade. So he hasn't actually done the 20th century US yet. He hasn't done the 19th century either. But you can sort of see in the classrooms kind of like little posters they put up and signs they put up and little aphorisms they post, and you know, it's like you get the picture. This total hagiography of kind of liberal icons drives me insane. I mean, like, it's just they become saints, you know.
All U.S. presidents were saints.
Well,
especially the ones who got shot.
Not well. It's sort of. I mean, not in Santa Monica. I mean, you know, this is like liberal lockdown. This is like big time. So
but
no,
there's also sacrifices. There's also sacrifices that people just want. Sorry, Thad, real quick. There's sacrifices. Like some presidents get sacrificed on the historical altar. Hoover.
Hoover. Yeah,
absolutely. To, you know, set the stage for Roosevelt.
Exactly.
So here's what I'm thinking. While we have a pause.
Yeah.
I have such a huge outline for this, of which I've checked off some items.
Okay.
I'd like to do it as maybe a two-parter. Would you come back, Antigone, and do another part?
Sure.
Because I really want to talk about a nice way to end, because it's a terrible subject. While we're talking about anti-Semitism, I wanted to just touch on the self-purification of Jews that you mentioned. And then next week, I'd really like to talk about Hollywood and the control of the press and the German film industry. Hollywood and Hollywood's relationship with the fascists. We talked earlier, you mentioned earlier in the show, Thad, about how when people hear words like Nazi or fascism, it's immediately these visions of Jews being loaded onto trains or Auschwitz or maybe if people are slightly more sophisticated, they might picture Mussolini shaking his fist. But, you know, there seems to be this effort, obviously, in mainstream American history to make this real clear divide between Germany and the United States in the 1930s. But, and of course, the big difference being the Holocaust, right? So that's what is all the spotlights, all the magnifying glasses go to this event. And they say this, Germany and America are, you know, night and day, opposite right. sides of everything. And all the similarities are overlooked because of this great tragedy. But one of the things that I thought was interesting that you talk about in the chapter is in America, at the same time that there's all this anti-Semitism going on in Germany, it seems like there's this self-purification happening among American Jews.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in hearing a little bit about what that is and a little bit about why that's happening.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the book, I think I call it a cultural Holocaust. And, you know, I had one person be upset about that. But, you know, I mean, kind of hard to deny it. I mean, so what we're talking about is assimilation,
yeah.
cultural assimilation by Jews
yeah.
Before World War II. So what was the objective of Jewish American leaders, like major rabbis, heads of Jewish American organizations, political organizations, Jewish Americans who had substantial cultural power, like the heads of Hollywood studios?
Yeah.
Yeah. So what was their stated objective? Okay. Well, we know what it was: to become fully American. It did not mean giving up their religion, although Reform Judaism came out of assimilationism, and Reform Judaism, which is now the dominant and has been for a long time, the dominant religion of American Jews, is a very, very, very different doctrine than Orthodox, original Judaism. For someone who's been around it a lot, and I was married by a Reform rabbi, to me, it often doesn't look like Judaism at all. But it was a deliberate, Reform Judaism was a deliberate, explicit attempt to assimilate into American life. You can't remain kosher, for instance, and not be weird in this culture, right? You stand apart. You sort of announce and every day, all day long, that you're different than almost everyone else. So, you know, and then there's all sorts of practices that were thrown overboard by American Jews in the establishment of Reform Judaism. But it went much deeper than that. I mean, so most Jews now don't really identify as Jewish and or certainly don't practice Judaism at all. That's the great majority of Jews in America. You know, I being one of them, I'm part Jewish. My mother's Jewish. But if you look at like the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, and you look at the sort of elite Jewish Americans, and in particular, the Hollywood moguls,
yeah.
the founders of Hollywood, they were as anti-Semitic as anyone you will find in the United States at the time. I mean, they hated Jewishness. They celebrated Christmas. They had gigantic Christmas parties. I mean, they made sort of anti-Semitic jokes all the time. And I'm talking about really nasty anti-Semitic jokes, like about how Jews should be killed.
That's the same kind of racism that you were talking about in Renegade History with like MLK. He's like, yay, yeah. black people, as long as you don't act black, don't listen to good music, listen to gospel, don't do this, do this.
Yeah, as long as you act like an American president, you know, publicly. Yeah, yeah, no, it's assimilationism, which has been, you know, so the Irish Americans were the first to do it in the early 19th century. And they stopped dancing, they started talking about drinking being a terrible thing. They adopted the Protestant work ethic.
They became cops.
That's crucial. They became cops and firefighters and politicians and soldiers. And they started becoming anti-black racists.
I often have to remind people that paddy wagon is a racist term.
So I'm part Irish too, so I can say whatever I want.
Look at you and all your identity cards.
I'm mostly black.
Right.
No, it's not racist. I mean, first of all, it's totally appropriate considering how the Irish very deliberately and successfully entered police forces, you know, in the cities in the 19th century. I mean, it was fucking terrible. They became basically, you know, the enforcers of American reactionary politics, you know, for a
yeah,
long time.
Yeah, and that's awful. It's like the worst thing you could do.
Racist. I mean, it's like they deserve that, you know, to have to have a vehicle of incarceration named after them. Yes, assimilation. So yeah, the Irish, the Italians, and then the Jews did it. You know, everyone's had a turn. You know, and African Americans have done it, tried to do it for longer. It's been a longer process for them. So you know, Barack Obama is kind of like the perfect. He's kind of the perfect example of African American assimilation. He is what Frederick Douglass and Ida B. Wells and W.E.B. Du Bois for a time, and Martin Luther King, certainly, and Jesse Jackson have all said black people should become, which is a guy in a business suit with a wife and two kids in a white house.
Well, I think he's had an unfair disadvantage because now we have mom jeans, and Obama in mom jeans really just pulls together the whole picture.
Yeah, no, right. Well, it's perfect though, right? Because now he's like, now that's the symbol of suburban white dad, right? Is the mom jeans.
There we go.
Why aren't they dad jeans?
They're just not, Brett.
it's like suburban, unhip, you know, urban.
Front wedgy kind of situation.
Urban is a synonym for black.
Black, right? Yeah.
So or Hispanic.
Anything that's suburban is white. Mm. And that's what it was. So yes, I mean, to call that a cultural holocaust, you know, okay. I mean, it's violent rhetoric. I get that. But like, I don't know what else to call it. It's the obliteration of a thing, in this case, a culture. You know, in the case of Germany in the 1940s, it was people. And that's a very important distinction to make. You know, we're not talking about the murder of human beings, of bodies, but we are talking about the murder of a culture. And that's what assimilationism is by definition. So it shouldn't be controversial. But anyway, so yes, that's what the Hollywood moguls did. And there's huge evidence. Neil Gabler wrote an awesome book, really fun read too, on the history of the original Hollywood Jewish moguls. They call it an empire of their own. He's got all the evidence in there of them being like just comically anti-Semitic. And these guys are all like the sons of Jewish immigrants from the Lower East Side of New York. I mean, they're like as Jewish as anybody ever could be. And they hated it and they wanted to assimilate fully. So your point, I mean, more important than what Marcus Lowe and the Warner Brothers and all those guys thought privately, of course, is what the movies they made. Was there anyone more important in determining, in shaping American culture than those guys? No, for the 40 or 50 years in which they were the boss of Hollywood. No, and what they did was they instituted the Motion Picture Production Code, commonly known as the Code, which went into effect in 1934. And, you know, I say it's not a coincidence that that was the first full year of the New Deal.
To be continued. If you understand objectivism, even just a surface understanding, you might be surprised to learn that a long time ago, philosophical discourse was split between rationalism and empiricism, right? Two separate camps. And the empiricists were people like Locke, the rationalists were people like Descartes and Plato. Now, an empiricist would say that the senses are the primary source of knowledge, that deduction cannot be trusted on its own.
Rationalists would say you cannot trust the senses, right? Induction cannot be trusted on its own. Kant comes along and basically says, wow, looks like you can't trust either of them. Because Kant's whole thing was this division between the phenomenal and the noumenal world, right? The phenomenal world was the apparent world, the world that we thought we lived in experienced. And the real world was the world that we didn't have access to. So it's almost the opposite of objectivism. Now, what's extra challenging in this situation is that my scholarship of Kant is limited, and he's very arcane and difficult to summarize, almost as if like he wanted to be. And this goes on. This thinking opens that door for Hegel, for Fichte, for others, thinkers, and I'm not just talking about philosophers, but political movements as well. So Kant is not the mastermind of the horror show in Germany in the 1800s and the 1900s. His ideas do have power, but not by themselves. They have power when combined with other forces. I mean, take Hitler, for example. Like, let's take this philosophical foundation of degrading reason and evidence. And Adolf Hitler writes this book in 1924 called Mein Kampf. Right, where he invents this legend of the Teutonic Knights, a real group. I don't want to get too into this either, but it's a real group, and they were like missionaries, and they also had a military function during the later Crusades. So Hitler takes them and he creates this like folklore version of them for his uses, for his purposes, to forward the idea of nationalism and sacrifice for the nation. And then it's used by Himmler in the establishment of the SS and even Goebbels for propaganda. And the Teutonic Knights were a real thing that existed at this time. And eventually the Nazis, I think in the late 1930s, wound up outlawing the order because reality was not jiving with the mysticism that they had created for their propaganda. Just one example. That's kind of Heaven's Gate-y non-objectivist thinking at work right there. It is not until the philosophy of objectivism comes along and they say, well, the empiricists, you can't trust deduction. The rationalists said you can't trust induction. Kant comes along and says you can't trust either of them. Then the objectivists come along and say, no, idiots. That is how they talk to people most of the time. You need both of them. Reality is an objective absolute. The senses take in information. Then reason integrates that information, forming abstractions and concepts. It's perceptual to conceptual. Not either or, and certainly not neither. Here's kind of a shorthand way to sum this up. In ancient Greece, we see these major advancements in thinking. And we see just over the course of three generations with the big three, things get increasingly rational, from Socrates and his daemon to Plato and his forms, ultimately to Aristotle and his system of logic. Increasing rationality. These ideas are embraced in the ancient world. They're understood. What the basic idea of objectivism is, it's not new. It goes back to the trivium, which is similar, which is thousands of years old, right? Here's a system that you can use to understand what is real, to understand what is true. The church comes along. They say, ha ha, fuck that. And it disappears. Okay, it's not until the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, where it comes back. And things are moving, you know, slowly at first, but moving in the right direction after the Enlightenment. Then the 19th century comes. And at the very beginning, the end of the 1700s, beginning of the 1800s, we have Kant, and we slide back. Objectivism takes us forward again to where we were as a human race thousands of years ago, what the ancient Greeks understood, some of them anyway. And meanwhile, there have been people who have understood this system all the while. There's people who understand this system today. We talked about this in the introduction to the fallacy series. They might get a prepackaged grammar, right, which they can argue in favor of very effectively, but they know how, there are people who know how to use this against you. This is what was occulted. This is what disappeared. The church is, you know, largely responsible for this, but the state has been a huge beneficiary as well. So that's Kant's impact on the broader philosophical picture, from my understanding.
So there's a real principled philosophical reason for not identifying as a libertarian, and then there's a strategic one.
Okay? Sure.
And I'm completely open, and I've said this to everyone openly. So the philosophical reason is, you know, takes a little bit of unpacking to understand, but there's my major difference with libertarians. And if you look at Jeff Riggenbach's review of my book, he nails it. He understands the difference, which is there is in libertarianism, well, classical liberalism, which is of course the root of libertarianism. There is what has been called the self-regulating individual, sort of bourgeois morality. And Ron Paul is a great exemplar of that. He understands it as well. And that's why he sort of preaches individual morality. You know, the argument being that if we regulate ourselves, the state won't have to, which is an intelligent argument. It's just that the problem is it means that this system, sort of this cosmology of libertarianism depends upon this intense moralism. You know, be in a family, don't have sex outside of marriage, you know, value work in itself, be responsible, all that stuff. I don't want to be a part of that. I think moralism is a very, it's just not my politics. I'm sort of, obviously, if you read two pages of my book, you'll understand that that's what I'm opposed to. And I think that libertarianism should be truly the politics of self-interest, you know? And that's what I'm interested in. I'm trying to develop a politics of self-interest, and so that means not moralizing against others unless they are doing harm to you, right? Well, not even then. Take that back. If someone's doing harm to you, don't moralize against them. Simply stop them.
Sure, sure. It sounds to me like you're kind of meeting out a postmodern view of morality.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, so. Another thing they don't understand is that law depends upon social norms, right? Law means nothing. Law has no teeth if there's no morality upholding it, right? So the example I always use is jaywalking in New York. Jaywalking is illegal in New York City, but everyone does it because there's no moral norm, right, upholding that law, right? So it gets flouted all the time. Sodomy laws, same thing, right? Sodomy is illegal still in several states. Do people practice sodomy in those states? Of course, every single day, because there's no real powerful norm upholding them. So libertarians need to be as opposed to restrictive moral norms as they are to restrictive law.
You have quite a storied history in academia as far as being ignored and condemned because you unveil truths to the higher-ups in academia that they don't want to acknowledge.
Kyle, hold on now.
Oh, sorry. What's happening?
You used a terrible word.
What is it?
Truth.
Oh, yeah, that's true. Oh, no.
Hey, man, we just talked about this. We're both postmodernists. We don't believe in truth. No, my book contains no truth at all. It doesn't. It's my argument. You can like it or not. That's all I ask, you know.
Sure,
you can like
sure.
Anyway, sorry. Continue.
No, that's fair. That's a good break. So, why should libertarians adopt a postmodern view of morality?
Well, for the reason I just stated. I mean that it's, you know, all the laws that libertarians hate depend upon morality.
Do you think there's also a strategic reason for it? Do you think it's a good backdoor into academia, which has accepted postmodernism as kind of the?
Yeah. Right. So if you look at, you know, one of my major influences within academia is queer theory.
Mm-hmm.
And that was one of the first things I noticed when I started becoming interested in libertarians was that they look a lot like queer theorists, which is.
That is the greatest compliment, by the way.
Which way? In which direction? Like, who's being complimented?
More libertarians.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I know. Yeah. But no, absolutely. The queer theory mission is to unsettle, decenter, denaturalize, challenge all claims of of essentialism, of things being rooted in nature, including morality, right? So is work in itself godly and virtuous? Well, only according to some people, that it's not written in nature anywhere that work is in itself is a good thing, or that sex outside of marriage is a bad thing, right? So let's get out of the business of essentializing ideas and norms and morality. If you're interested in freedom, I mean, if you're interested in personal freedom, this seems a no-brainer to me, that you've got to challenge these ideas that are rooted in places like the church and in the state, that particular ways of living that harm no one else are evil or unnatural, right? We've got to challenge it if we are interested in personal freedom.
Sure, sure. And I think it's the most natural pairing because, you know, it's an uncomfortable thing for a lot of modern academia to accept, but postmodernism in many ways is explicitly anti-Marxist.
Right, exactly. It emerged as a reaction to Marxism, as a matter of fact, right? Marxism does a lot of rooting of things in nature, right? Like, you know, the class struggle, for instance, and, you know, the idea that there's this inevitable revolution coming out of capitalism, that capitalism produces these things inevitably. Well, no, actually. But more importantly, the historical materialism, right, is in itself essentialism. It's saying that history, social norms, everything comes out of some material basis of society that can't be argued about, right? It just is. It's an objective fact. There's a belief in objective facts, objective truths in Marx, that you must challenge if you were interested in personal liberty, if you were interested in intellectual freedom, if you were interested in free minds and free markets, you've got to challenge that.